Tonight on PBS News Weekend, terror in Moscow. The deadliest massacre in decades leaves Russia on edge just days after President Vladimir Putin was re-elected.
They were just walking and shooting as they went along. There were five or six of them. They were just walking and gunning down everyone methodically in silence.
Then the working conditions for migrant farm workers and the role they play in U.S. economic growth. And how the residents of a small Wisconsin town are dealing with a surge in migrants. Good evening, I'm John Yang. Russian President Vladimir Putin has vowed to punish those responsible for the terror attack on a suburban Moscow concert hall that killed at least 133 people and, according to Russian officials, left about 145 more wounded. It was one of the worst acts of terror in Russia in decades. Throughout Russia tonight, security has been beefed up, and in Moscow, people are remembering the dead and offering help to the wounded. Hundreds of people lined up in the rain this morning in Moscow to donate blood and plasma, giving what they can for the wounded from last night's carnage.
Of course, I was shocked and felt fear and horror. I've been to a concert at Crocus myself, and when I saw those horrible videos, I was shocked and in tears even now when I speak about it. It was very scary to see it all.
A branch of the Islamic State based in Afghanistan claimed responsibility for the attack. It began with gunmen storming the hall, firing point blank at people who had gathered for a rock concert. Dave Primov was among the crowd.
The shots were not sporadic. They were constant volleys of gunfire. We all got up and tried to move closer to the aisles. People began to panic, started to run, and collided with each other. Some fell down and others trampled on them.
Witnesses said the attackers threw explosive devices that started a fire. This morning, a smoldering ruin was all that was left after the roof collapsed. Investigators combed through wreckage looking for bodies and evidence. In an address to the nation, Russian President Vladimir Putin said all the gunmen had been arrested. He never mentioned the ISIS claim of responsibility, instead linking Ukraine to the attack.
Now the main thing is to not let those behind this bloodbath commit new crimes. All four of the actual performers of the act of terror, all those who shot and killed people, were found and detained. They tried to hide and were moving in the direction of Ukraine. There, according to preliminary data, they had a crossing of the border prepared from the Ukrainian side.
Putin provided no evidence to support his claim, and Kyiv denied any involvement. U.S. intelligence said they had warned Russian officials of a planned ISIS attack in Moscow. Outside the ruins of the concert hall today, people left flowers at a makeshift memorial. Among them, concertgoer Anastasia Rodinova, who says she feels lucky to be alive.
They were just walking and shooting as they went along, gunning down everyone methodically in silence. You understand only now that you are lucky, really lucky. I came home, my coat was just covered in blood. Apparently someone shielded me.
Putin declared tomorrow a national day of mourning as the search goes on for answers about the brutal attack. Journalist Michael Weiss is the editor of The Insider, an independent news outlet covering Russia. He's also co-author of ISIS Inside the Army of Terror. Michael, what do we know about ISIS-K, this branch of ISIS that's claimed responsibility?
So ISIS-K is established in Afghanistan, and they are ranged against a host of other jihadi actors, including the Taliban, al-Qaeda, and they've been angling to hit Russia for quite a while. If you look at their communiques and their propaganda, they revile Vladimir Putin, one of the reasons being that Russia maintains a partnership with the Taliban, their sworn enemy. The United States has fairly good intelligence on their capability and their motivation because we occupied Afghanistan for more than 20 years. And clearly, our departure has not really interfered with the ability to collect signals intelligence, which is what I believe the United States passed along to Moscow a little less than a month ago. On March 7th, you'll recall the U.S. Embassy put out a notice advising people to stay away from public events for the next 48 hours. And that indeed, according to reporting, was tied to a credible ISIS-K threat planned for Russia.
And according to reporting, they also passed along that information to the Russians. Why did Russian security miss this?
Well, we don't know that they did. I mean, it's always possible that some guys can slip through or that the intelligence was not specific enough to identify the time, place, and the kind of culprits that would be behind it. But look, I mean, it's no mystery that Russia's security and military resources are predominantly poured into the war of conquest in Ukraine. And also at the domestic level, there's a huge crackdown on dissent. People arrested at Alexei Navalny's funeral a few weeks ago. They're cracking down on any kind of anti-war demonstrations or protests. You know, if you so much as post a news article from the New York Times about Russian casualties in Ukraine, you could be thrown in jail for several years. So what we're seeing emerge in Russia is a kind of neo-totalitarian state. And under those conditions, the idea that, you know, the perfidious Americans are claiming that ISIS-K or some Islamist group is trying to attack Russia. You can imagine the paranoia at the level of the Kremlin, that they probably wouldn't credit that as plausible. They would see it as some kind of psychological operation. And I mean, indeed, President Putin came out today and sort of pointed the finger at Ukraine, even though it is highly implausible that Ukraine had anything to do with this whatsoever.
Not only pointed the finger at Ukraine, he didn't mention the ISIS claim of responsibility at all. What do you think is going on with that?
Well, it's embarrassing to Putin, right? I mean, you know, the kind of leitmotif of his reign, at least in the first decade and a half, was to reconstitute Fortress Russia, to make Russia this kind of impenetrable security state, which had all but withered away with the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, Putin himself, famously a former lieutenant colonel in the KGB. The KGB was colloquially known as the sword and the shield, right? It was there to protect the state and the sanctity of the state. So for him, he's got a lot of egg on his face right now, because this wasn't just a kind of a terror attack where, you know, some lone wolf drove a car into a crowd. This was highly sophisticated. This had been planned for months, if you take ISIS at their word. The Russian security services claim to have detained four of the assailants. And this was a, you know, machine gun fire into a crowded mall and concert venue, but also a fire set to burn the whole place down, which it looks very much like they succeeded in that respect. And now we're talking about over 100 people dead and many more wounded. So this is going to be a trauma in Russia. And so Putin, I think, is, as is his wont, is trying to deflect blame away from himself, to point the finger at, you know, mysterious dark forces that are arrayed against Russia. The question is, are the Russian people going to buy it this time?
And what would you expect Putin to use this as sort of as a pretense in the war with Ukraine?
Well, that's one of the fears. Yeah, I mean, if he's saying that, you know, the long dark arm of the Ukrainian intelligence services, and of course behind them, keep in mind he always blames the United States. He thinks of Ukraine as a vassal, not with no agency or sovereignty of its own. But if he's pointing the finger at Ukraine, suggesting that, you know, these jihadis were making their way for the Russian-Ukrainian border. Not a very clever exit strategy for anybody who's just carried out an attack like that, by the way. One could then hypothesize he's using that as a pretext to escalate. Now, you know, Russia has begun to refer to this operation in Ukraine, which is a war, as a war. It's no longer just a special military operation. There's been all kinds of rumors and reporting in the Russian press about a possible mobilization campaign, meaning a huge call up, not a partial mobilization like before, possibly another attempted attack to conquer Kharkiv in northeast Ukraine, a city that had been one of the main targets in February of 2022. So we don't know. And as you can imagine, because of this, it's led to any number of conspiracy theories. I've seen many Ukrainians suggest that the Russians themselves may have planned this as a false flag attack akin to the Moscow apartment bombings. Ukrainian military intelligence suggested as much. In this case, I have to be honest. I mean, you know, I've spent a long time studying ISIS and their tactics and their motives. And it certainly seems to me like what you see is what you get here. ISIS-K looking to attack Russia and succeeding in a spectacular fashion.
Michael Weiss, editor of The Insider. Thank you very much.
Sure, anytime.
President Biden signed a $1.2 trillion spending bill to fund more than half the federal government through the end of the current budget year on September 30th. Final passage came in the Senate at about 2 a.m., averting a partial government shutdown. The measure includes a pay raise for the military and increased border security spending. Not included, aid for either Israel or Ukraine. Lawmakers are expected to take up those two items in early April after a two-week recess. Egypt says about 7,000 aid trucks are being denied entry into Gaza as the United Nations warns of imminent famine. On the Egyptian side of the Rafah border crossing, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said blocking the aid deliveries is a moral outrage. He said it was time to truly flood Gaza with aid, as he put it, and called for an immediate ceasefire. A Russian spacecraft blasted off from Kazakhstan today, taking a crew of three to the International Space Station for a six-month stay. Teams made up of an American, a Russian, and a Belarusian. It's one of the last remaining collaborations between Russia and the West. And Laurent de Brunhoff has died. He was the author and illustrator of the beloved children's series Babar the Elephant. He'd been in hospice care for several weeks. Babar was the creation of his father, Jean de Brunhoff. After he died, Laurent nurtured his creation and, as his father did, provided the illustrations of the Elephant King of Celesteville. It grew into a global franchise. De Brunhoff was 98 years old. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, the living and working conditions for migrant workers on dairy farms, and how a small Wisconsin town is dealing with the recent surge of migrants.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
Advocates of legal immigration say foreign-born workers have long been a key factor in U.S. economic growth, and researchers say they've been crucial to the jobs recovery after the pandemic. But are immigrant workers sharing in the benefits of their contributions? For more than a year, ProPublica has been looking into the harsh realities of life for immigrant workers on Midwest dairy farms. Melissa Sanchez is a ProPublica reporter. She focuses on immigrants and low-wage workers. Melissa, over this several months of working on this story, what are the biggest takeaways that you came out of this reporting with?
Sure. A few of them are just how dangerous the work is. I wasn't aware of it, but workers are routinely injured, and it's almost a normalized thing. Like, workers say that if you haven't been hurt on a farm, then you really haven't worked on one before. So the danger is one thing, and then also the lack of regulation. Like, even though it's very dangerous, dairy work is less regulated than other kinds of work for a number of reasons, but particularly workers on small farms have fewer protections. And then the immigrant nature of the work. Almost everybody that I've met is an undocumented immigrant from Central America or Mexico who's on these farms.
These farms are less regulated than other agricultural operations. Why is that?
So it's basically a technicality. The way the laws are written, some of the farm worker protection laws that we have, they apply only to work that's seasonal or temporary, and cows are milked year-round. And that distinction sort of leaves this class of workers out. But we know that farm workers are sort of exempt from a lot of other labor laws and protections, including overtime pay, for example. And, you know, workers' comp laws often don't cover small farms, and a lot of these folks work on small farms. There's just like one after another of laws that leaves these people out.
Tell us what sort of an average day is like for these workers.
The days are pretty wild. One thing to know is that workers work 60 to 80 hours a week, kind of on a regular basis, and the shifts are scattered. They might start a shift from 4 a.m. to 10 a.m., and then again from noon to 2, and then again from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m., and this kind of erratic schedule makes it very difficult to sleep. And then depending on what their job is, it's either a lot of repetitive motions of putting on and taking off these tubes onto the teats of cows to pump out the milk, or it's work of shoveling and scraping cow manure and taking it to a manure lagoon on the site. It's pretty heavy, dangerous work.
And aside from the work, what are the living conditions like?
I think one of the most important things to know is that it's really isolating work. People live in rural communities, often on the farms where they work. So it's routine for farmers to provide housing to their workers. And there's very little, if any, regulation on that housing. So we've seen workers who have decent, you know, mobile homes on a property, and we've seen houses on site with black mold in the bathroom ceilings, or, you know, cockroaches, mice, ceilings that are caving in. When you live at work, you're living near your boss constantly, which is really hard to imagine. And part of the reason for that is that you can't drive legally if you're undocumented in Wisconsin. And so workers are essentially trapped at work.
How dependent or how important are these workers to the dairy industry in Wisconsin?
I mean, I've had so many farmers tell me that their businesses would collapse without immigrant dairy workers. I mean, farmers won't tell you on the record that they knowingly hire people who are undocumented, but off the record, they will. They have to. They say that they can't hire U.S.-born citizens to do this work. And again, the shifts are really intense, and the pay isn't much better than what you would get at McDonald's. So if you have a choice between shoveling cow manure all day or you know, flipping burgers, you might choose the latter.
Is there a difference in the conditions, either the working conditions or living conditions, for immigrants who are in the country legally and immigrants who are in the country illegally?
So yes and no. So it's important to know that with dairy in particular, there's no guest worker program. There's no like agricultural guest worker program that they're able to access because dairy work is year round, unlike seasonal crop labor. And so other kinds of agricultural work does often and increasingly rely on legal immigrant guest workers. Their conditions, it's hard to say whether it's significantly better, but there are some more regulations and standards for that category of work and then the housing, et cetera. And we've interviewed easily 130, 140 workers over the past year and a half. All but three or four were undocumented immigrants.
I know you asked some of the people you talked to reach out to you using a messaging app and leave some messages about this. We've translated them into English. Let's listen to two of them.
How was my experience working as an undocumented migrant in a dairy farm? The truth is it has been one of the most difficult work experiences of my life. It wasn't because of the work itself, but because of the way my boss would address me, with insults and lack of respect. He would do this knowing that as undocumented, we always fear asking for help because of our migrant status. It was very difficult to work for this person. I believe that in all my working years, this has been the most difficult, and I hope that it doesn't happen again, because it really lowers your self-esteem.
The reality of being a migrant is very complicated, because the fact that we are in this country illegally, there are many things we have to be silent about. I think that the fear all migrants have is to be quiet, even if we for some reason decide to complain that some things are not right. Sometimes it can be about where we live or how bad the pay is, but we're still migrants, and it's best if we're quiet and don't complain.
How representative or how typical are these messages to what you heard in your reporting?
It's just extremely typical. I mean, a lot of workers feel that they're treated like less than human from their employers, but they can't really do anything about it because of their immigration status. It's really hard for people like that to speak up, to be willing to use their name. They're afraid of getting fired, getting evicted, getting deported, and it's they're just real and present fears for these folks.
Did you ask the farmers or the people who run these farms about these conditions, and what was their response?
Yeah, you know, we talked to maybe a dozen or so farmers over the past year and a half. And it's hard. They're in a tight spot financially. They can't control the price of milk, and they don't always know what they're going to make. And a lot of farms, as you know, like go into bankruptcy each year. So they're not really required to do a whole lot. There's just not a lot of regulations for them. So a lot of them believe that they're doing the best they can for their workers. But when it comes to things like injuries, we've heard farmers kind of blame workers for their own problems, including their own deaths on the farm. And because there's little oversight, they're just not held accountable.
Melissa Sanchez of ProPublica, thanks very much for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you for having me.
The complications resulting from the influx of migrants isn't limited to just big cities like New York and Chicago. PBS Wisconsin's Nathan Denzine went to a small city in southern Wisconsin to see the effects there.
It's another generation of families coming here trying to get jobs, you know, feed their children, get their children through school.
Since 2022, around 800 to 1,000 migrants from Central and South America have come to Whitewater, Wisconsin, putting a strain on local resources. Some of the most vulnerable in that population are children.
We're trying our best to really, how can we advocate for these children?
Miguel Aranda is a member of the Whitewater School Board and a second-generation immigrant from Mexico. With this new influx of students, Aranda says the school district needs more funding. Wisconsin currently sits on a $3 billion budget surplus.
I would understand if there's no money, we have to make hard decisions. But to know that there is a surplus, it almost looks like the money is being dwindled right in front of our faces.
But there are people and organizations who have already stepped up to act as a stopgap for the new arrivals.
Our mission is to meet the needs of the community, whatever they are.
We know that they're here because if they've never been here before and they come in and see all these things and we tell them that they can just have it, they don't understand.
Christine Zabios and Kay Robers are co-founders of the Community Space in Whitewater. Their mission is to provide everything a person might need, from bedding to furniture to food, all for free.
I've had the privilege of witnessing somebody coming in, you know, maybe having their worst day, and coming in and just needing some support, some food, some whatever, and seeing them slowly relax and realize we're not going to ask them for any papers.
The Community Space has been accepting donations since 2019, but has ramped up its efforts in the last 2 years.
Well, I'd certainly like to say that there has been no crisis. Have we had to stretch and adjust? Absolutely.
They are open Tuesdays, Wednesday nights, and Saturdays as a complement to the local food pantry.
I can stand up in the middle of the room and say, is there anyone here that's bilingual? And inevitably, I'll get a 9-year-old child, which is awesome, you know. And I always say to the child, you know, isn't your mother proud of you? Tell her you did a really good job and we're proud of you.
We like to think that half of what we do is what we share and give away, and half of what we do is how we make people feel.
Beyond food and shelter, migrants face a number of challenges when they first get here. Finding a job, speaking a new language, and driving are top of mind. Jorge Islas Martinez, an advocate and a first-generation immigrant from Mexico, says undocumented migrants are not allowed to obtain a driver's license in Wisconsin.
We don't have public transportation. The only transportation that we have is taxi. The taxi only is available here in Whitewater from 7:30 in the morning until 5 o'clock.
I see it as a huge safety issue. I mean, if we're having people, especially driving in snow for the first time, that is not a good situation.
Dan Meyer is the chief of police in Whitewater.
If somebody's able to come here and take all of the testing, the written test, physically do the driving test so that they are safer as a driver, I'm all for that.
Nearly 20 states allow undocumented immigrants to obtain a driver's license.
I think the underlying theory here is that we know we need resources. For us in law enforcement, this is apolitical. We simply need more staffing.
Meyer says that over the last 2 years, his department's work has gotten much more difficult and time-consuming.
One of the things that has been difficult for us as law enforcement is just working with a population that generally speaking, is not trusting of government because they come from a place where they don't trust their government.
To try and get some help for the city, Meyer and city officials sent a letter to state and federal officials in December.
We need more officers so that we can get out and patrol at the level that the community is used to having us out there.
But the letter requested more than just a boost in law enforcement funding.
This is a situation where we are a poor town that has limited resources and not enough shared revenue from the state, and we would like to help people make sure that they're getting jobs, you know, shelter, food, all those things.
Brienne Brown is a member of the Whitewater Common Council.
The real problem is not that there are people here, it's just that the city's not prepared.
Meyer and Brown say they have heard from local officials who seem willing to help. In January, Senator Tammy Baldwin, a Democrat, wrote a letter to President Biden. She called for federal support for cities in Wisconsin, including Whitewater, to help with the influx of migrants. During a visit to Whitewater in November, Republican Senator Ron Johnson blamed what he called a flood of migrants on the Biden administration. Immigrant advocates worry the new arrivals will become political scapegoats. They want to see these new neighbors welcomed to their close community.
It's really contributing to the vitality of our community. It is where we see the future.
For PBS News Weekend, I'm Nathan Denzine in Whitewater, Wisconsin.
And that is PBS News Weekend for this Saturday. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow.